Tom Woodchuck, Wolverine Goose, Whippoorwill, Chipmunk, Jackal Moose, Mud Turtle, Whale, Glowworm Bat, Salamander Snail, and a Maltese Cat, Black Squirrel, Coon, Opossum, Wren, Red Squirrel.
For the new puzzle, I'm looking for a word that is a type of bird, but is also the sound of a different bird. So again, send me a type of bird that is also the word for the sound a different bird makes. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Flying birds. Excellent birds. Watch them fly.
There they go. This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of April 8th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KPOV News for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Eric Tegadoff, Mark Moran, and Catherine Carley. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Starvation in Gaza, the vulnerability of aid workers in Gaza, and Democrats up the pressure on Biden over arms to Israel. Starvation in Gaza. By now, we are all familiar with the appalling food situation in all parts of Gaza. Now, a multi-party global initiative, known for short as the IPC, which stands for Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, has documented and closely analyzed the matter. Half the Gaza population, 1.1 million people, now face catastrophic food insecurity. Unless a ceasefire can be agreed upon, by July, just about the entire population will be in that condition. Moreover, quote, famine is imminent in the northern governorates and projected to occur anytime between mid-March and May of 2024. The report further notes, quote, the famine threshold for household acute food insecurity has already been far exceeded, and given the latest data showing a steeply increasing trend in cases of acute malnutrition, it is highly likely that the famine threshold for acute malnutrition has already been exceeded, unquote. Delivery of food and other basic necessities is a major cause of the famine. Quoting from the report, from a pre-escalation average of 500 trucks a day, of which 150 carrying food, in the period between October 7, 2023 and February 24 of this year, only 90 trucks per day, of which only 60 carrying food, entered the Gaza Strip. Consequently, virtually all households are skipping meals every day, and adults are reducing their meals so that children can eat. In the northern governorates, in nearly two-thirds of the households, people went entire days and nights without eating at least 10 times in the last 30 days. In the southern governorates, this applies to one-third of the households, unquote. What we may not be aware of is just how destitute the Gaza Strip was before the war. The IPC report reminds us, quote, in 2022, the Gaza Strip faced an unemployment rate of nearly 45%. And by September 2023, the poverty rate was at 60% among a population that included nearly 70% of refugees. Due to severely constrained livelihood opportunities, in 2022, over half of the population was relying on humanitarian assistance as their main income source, and about one-third on casual labor, with 70% of the population food insecure, unquote. As I noted in my earlier broadcast on opinion polling of Palestinians, a common comment was that the war had finally focused international attention on Gaza's desperate conditions. The vulnerability of aid workers in Gaza. Adding to the food insecurity in Gaza is the perilous condition for humanitarian relief workers. That was brought home with the death of seven members of the World Central Kitchen in an Israeli raid that the Israeli Defense Forces has called a tragic mistake. Prior to that attack, 196 aid workers had been killed in the war between last October and late March. That's an astounding figure when, according to a group that tracks humanitarian assistance projects, no aid workers had been killed in all the occupied territories in the three previous years. Nor has any conflict zone ever experienced so many deaths of aid workers. The unprecedented number of aid worker deaths in Gaza has raised accusations that relief organizations are being deliberately targeted. As one writer puts it, quote, Israeli forces have targeted healthcare facilities, aid convoys, and ambulances with apparent impunity. Aid groups say they have shared the GPS coordinates of their facilities and convoys with Israeli authorities to avoid unintentional bombing, a strategy known as deconfliction, but aid facilities continue to be hit. There is complete disregard for the norms of modern warfare, said Bob Kitchen, Vice President for Emergencies and Humanitarian Action at the International Rescue Committee. Now, according to a report in the New Humanitarian, Israel has set up a separate, privately contracted aid system that it can protect and control, avoiding reliance on the UN's relief organization as well as on non-governmental organizations. Democrats up the pressure on Biden over arms to Israel. More and more Democrats are distancing themselves from President Biden's policy on the war in Israel. Though they differ in the ways they prefer to punish Israel for its human rights violations in Gaza, they are as one in believing the U.S. needs to use aid as leverage against the Netanyahu government's offensive. Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland has been leading the way. Responding to Biden's latest statement demanding that Israel facilitate humanitarian aid, Van Hollen said, quote, I was glad to see the president indicate that he's going to monitor compliance and base U.S. policy going forward on the government meeting these requirements. That suggests no more anything goes when it comes to policies toward the Netanyahu government. Van Hollen wants the U.S. to make three changes. First, in accordance with U.S. policy, under National Security Memorandum 20, it should suspend the transfer of offensive weapons to Israel if it fails at reducing civilian harm or getting desperately needed assistance to people in need under NSM 20. Second, it should stop blocking UN Security Council resolutions critical of Israel. And third, it should be more forthright about U.S. policy in public statements. A few other senators have chimed in with different ideas. Senator Elizabeth Warren said she would suspend the sale of F-15 jet fighters to Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders said, quote, Israel should not be getting another nickel in military aid unless these policies are fundamentally changed. In the House, 39 Democrats signed a letter to the president on April 5, urging that the administration, quote, withhold any offensive weapons transfer, pending a finding on Israel's possible violations of international law. But most Democrats critical of Israel aren't willing to go that far. Moreover, note that even Van Hollen has left wiggle room for the administration by giving it time to work with the Israeli government on policy changes. Now Biden can point to a quick decision by Netanyahu to order the opening of a new port and border crossing for humanitarian aid deliveries. That move will hardly alleviate Gaza's suffering, but the administration can use it to suggest that its warnings to Netanyahu are being heard. In other news, starvation in Sudan. Let's remind ourselves that war and famine are not limited to the Israel-Hamas war. Sudan's civil war is another case. The fighting between the army and a paramilitary force has caused enormous suffering and another refugee crisis. Millions of people, especially women and children, have fled either to South Sudan or to next-door Chad. But food aid trucks within Sudan are constantly attacked and looted, while in Chad, money for aid is about to end. Of course, hunger is just one consequence of this war. Like all others, war means destruction of schools and hospitals, extremely limited health care, disrupted harvests, exceptional inflation. But for the civilian casualties, Sudan is a tragedy just as great as that in Gaza. Next, two stories from Latin America. Mexico's president makes clear his liberal left credentials. Andrés Manuel López Obrador did this on two very different occasions. First, on U.S. immigration policy, speaking on 60 Minutes, March 24th, López Obrador offered a startling proposal for Mexico's cooperation on the U.S. immigration problem. The U.S. must meet four conditions, he said. Commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S. Asked if this proposal constituted blackmail, López Obrador said no, he was speaking frankly about what the U.S. needed to do, though he also said Mexico would still work with the U.S. as a matter of necessity. Hard to imagine the U.S. accepting any of his conditions, though they do speak to the so-called push factors that lead desperate people to seek entry into the U.S. at great personal risk. The second occasion occurred following a brazen invasion of Mexico's embassy in Ecuador by police who stormed in and seized a former vice president who has been convicted of corruption. The man had sought asylum in the embassy, which normally would make him untouchable under international law. López Obrador denounced the violation of Mexican sovereignty and broke relations. The UN Secretary General and several Latin American governments, left and right, condemned the violation of the embassy. This extraordinary event comes on the heels of Mexican President López Obrador's strong criticism of Ecuador's new conservative government and the assassination of a leading anti-corruption presidential candidate in Ecuador who was evidently favored by Mexico. He has also been in conflict with the Peruvian and Bolivian governments, which are also conservative and which have withdrawn their ambassadors in protest of Mexican criticism. The second story comes from Guatemala, where the president apologized for a 20-year-old murder. In 2001, a 15-year-old girl was slain in Guatemala, and the police did nothing about it. Now the country's president personally apologized to the family. The backstory here is important. Guatemala has the highest rate of killings of women in Central America, and the girl's mother has led the fight to reform the judicial system and bring attention to violence against women and girls. She fought for justice all the way to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which ruled in 2014 that Guatemala violated the human rights of the daughter and ordered the nation to apologize to her family. Her efforts also led to a national alert system instituted to respond to the disappearances of Guatemalan women and girls more quickly. The alert, which is sent out 6 hours after a disappearance, is named after the daughter and another teenager who was 19 when she was killed in 2005. Germany's changing view of the Israel-Hamas war. German historical memory counts heavily in its long-standing support of Israel, but history is becoming less important as Israel's violations of international law mount. When the war began in October, Chancellor Olaf Scholz declared that Germany had, quote, only one place, and it is alongside Israel. But last week, standing beside Prime Minister Netanyahu, Scholz said, quote, no matter how important the goal, can it justify such terribly high costs? Likewise, Germany's foreign minister is heading a delegation to Israel because it is, quote, obliged to remind all parties of their duty to abide by international humanitarian law. That represents quite a change from Germany's defense of Israel before the International Court of Justice, when South Africa brought a charge of genocide before the court a few months ago. In all, Germany is being forced by circumstance to make its position on human rights violations in Gaza conform with its position on Russian violations in Ukraine. What next for Putin? Despite the terrorist attack in Moscow by the ISIS-K group, or perhaps because of it, Vladimir Putin may be plotting ways to exploit the incident to intensify and even expand his war effort. Russian air assaults on Ukraine civilian targets provide one indication that Putin, by blaming Ukraine and the U.S. for being behind the terrorism, may think he has support for widening the war. As one Europe-based Russia expert explains, quote, it would show ordinary Russians that those who harm them will be punished, divert attention from the security establishment's failure to prevent the attack, and perhaps even generate greater support for the war, unquote. And the timing is right. Putin has been reelected, Ukraine's forces are being pushed back, and U.S. aid to Ukraine is tied up in Congress. Ukraine may not be the only sign of Putin's ambitions. Poland, where a Russian missile crossed the border, could be next. Meanwhile, two leading Republicans in Congress, Michael McCaul of Texas, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and Michael Turner of Ohio, chair of the House Permanent Committee on Intelligence, said that Russian propaganda had, in McCaul's words, infected a good chunk of my party's base. Anti-Ukraine, pro-Russia messages are being uttered on the House floor, said Turner, that are directly coming from Russia. Finally, some notes from the Israel-Hamas war. First, the 14-day siege of Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest in Gaza, is over. Hundreds of bodies litter the hospital area, which has been completely decimated. According to the Israeli military, 900 suspected militants had been detained, and more than 500 of these had been identified as members of Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Second, the Israeli Defense Forces are moving forces from the south of Gaza, supposedly to recuperate and prepare for future operations, quote-unquote. What that means for the long-anticipated attack on Rafah is unclear, though Netanyahu has reiterated his aim to invade the city. Leaders of the far right in Israel have threatened to withdraw support from Netanyahu over the IDF redeployments, which could relate to new tensions with Iran. Third, Israel is on high alert for an Iranian response after its air force killed several senior Iranian commanders this past week. The Israeli attack was on an Iranian embassy building in Damascus on Monday, and it killed General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a top commander in Iran's Quds force, as well as several other commanders and senior officers. Fourth, the cost so far of damage to Gaza's infrastructure is estimated by the World Bank and United Nations to be $18.5 billion. And finally, no progress has been reported in ongoing negotiations in Cairo. Neither side is budging on key issues, such as the return of people to northern Gaza, numbers of hostages and prisoners to be released, and the Israeli Defense Forces troops stationed in Gaza. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Birdie. Major U.S. corporations paid less in federal income taxes between 2018 and 2022 than they pay their top executives. That's according to a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies. David Cass is the executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the findings of the report.
So something's not fair with the way these corporate executives get paid as compared to how these companies pay their taxes. How does that happen? I mean, I guess that's sort of standard procedure now. I mean, the companies will say, well, we have to pay these people so much money because otherwise we can't attract the talent. And the other companies will get these valuable people and we will be deprived of them. Is that kind of the argument they use?
Right. And, you know, as I think President Biden said, nobody's against corporate executives getting paid, you know, some wage. The question is just how vast a difference there should be between them and everybody else. And so we released this report where we found that there are 35 major U.S. corporations in the country, you know, names that you know, Ford, Netflix, Tesla, and they paid their top five corporate executives more than they paid in federal taxes. Now, that's pretty crazy, right? I mean, and they were all profitable over a five-year span, too. So they were making money, but they weren't paying much in taxes. And so what we found was that over this period, they paid their executives $9.5 billion, with a B, but they paid actually a negative tax rate. So they got a refund of $1.8 billion. So they paid their corporate executives $9.5 billion, and they got a refund from the government for $1.8 billion.
So is this unprecedented in the history of U.S. corporate taxation, or is this something new?
So things absolutely have been getting worse. That, you know, the effective corporate tax rate has been going down for a long time. And, you know, we found that it's not just these 35 corporations, though, that we found that there are an additional 29 corporations that were profitable, and they paid their corporate executives more than they paid in taxes in two of the 5 years. And listen to this, in 18 corporations, they were profitable over the five-year period, but they paid $0 in federal income taxes. And so their effective tax rate was 2.8%. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd be happy to pay just a couple of percents on my income. You know, why are these big, profitable, wealthy corporations paying so little in taxes?
How do they do it? Is it just tax loopholes? How would you explain that?
One of the things that happened was in 2017, the Trump tax cut was passed, and it dramatically lowered the tax rate in corporations. It was 35%, and they dropped it to 21%. So a 40% drop, right? So that's a big piece of it. And then there are all these loopholes. And you know, that's why we're saying that corporations should pay their fair share of taxes. Because it affects everybody, right? When there's not enough, when corporations aren't paying their taxes, there's not enough money to fund defense, to fund education, to fund housing. It has a direct impact on every American. So, you know, and so I think President Biden in his budget called for raising taxes on corporations. It was an important call. And so, you know, we're supporting these changes.
There was a time back in the 50s during the Eisenhower administration where the, I guess you would call it the personal tax rate for super rich people was 91%. What was the corporate tax rate at that time? Do you happen to know?
You know, I'd have to double check exactly for that year. But yes, it was much higher than it is now. And it has kept going down. And so let me just give you an example of how things are now. So let's take Tesla, for example. So over the last 5 years, their executives were paid $2.5 billion. They made $4.4 billion in profit. That's what their income tax was, minus $1 million. So they paid less than zero. You know, they're the eighth most valuable corporation in the world, as at least the end of last year. They're worth $800 billion. It's run by one of the wealthiest people in the world, Elon Musk. And despite all that wealth, they've never paid a nickel in federal income taxes. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
I remember during the Greek economic crisis of a few years ago, one of the comments or one of the criticisms about what was going on there was that rich people didn't pay their taxes.
Right.
Is it as bad here as it was there? Or I don't know, has anyone done a comparative study of how the U.S. ranks in terms of corporate tax cheating or whatever you want to call it?
Well, it is certainly true that over the last decade, the IRS has been, their budget has been cut dramatically by Republicans. And the impact has been that, you know, if you don't have, corporations have pretty complicated tax returns. So you need people at the IRS who really know what's going on so can dig into it. And the IRS hasn't had enough people. Fortunately, in 2022, Democrats passed this big additional money for the IRA, for the IRS. And that's starting to pay off already. So, you know, there's the wait times that for customers to call the IRS has gone down, but also they're able to go after corporate tax cheats. Because, you know, our message is just like, if you owe taxes, you got to pay them. Just like you and me, like we all have to pay it. That's the law. Why should corporations be any different?
Okay, so the IRS has lost people. Does that mean they don't do audits on these corporations?
Right, so the audits have dropped dramatically over the last decade. And so I think that this additional funding that's going to the IRS is really helpful to go after tax cheats, right? Everybody wants people, if you owe money, you should pay it. But if you know that there's nobody who's going to come after you, there's an incentive to cheat. So, you know, we need the funding of the IRS to make sure that corporations and wealthy individuals, you know, the super wealthy, pay their taxes.
And in terms of the executive salaries, is there a kind of cultural problem there that somehow the idea is so prevalent that these people need to be paid these exorbitant salaries? I mean, why are they considered so valuable when it's really the people under them that do so much of the work?
Now, corporate CEOs are being paid, you know, 300 times more than the average worker. And it was used to be much, much less than that. So absolutely, it is. And you know, as President Biden said in the State of the Union speech, you know, look, we're not against paying it. It's just the government shouldn't subsidize, shouldn't get a tax break for, you know, paying more than $1 million. Like, you want to pay more than that? Your corporation, you can do that. But you shouldn't get a tax break for doing that.
Well, Biden, you know, he was the senator from Delaware. That's a big corporate state where companies go to get better breaks. And he kind of carried water for them for years, right? Why do you think he's kind of shifting here? Or is he? Or is this just too outrageous that even someone like Biden has to say something?
Well, you know, I think the proof is in the pudding. There were very specific proposals in his budget that he released, and which, you know, would raise taxes on raise the corporate tax rate, say that, you know, if you pay your executives more than $1 million, you don't get a subsidy. So I think there's some really important policies that would rein in some of these loopholes.
And was there or were there any moves in Congress in recent years to do those kind of things? I mean, before he made this.
Yeah, so I think one of the important steps that Democrats took when they were in control in 2022 was they said that corporations have to pay a minimum tax of 15%. And I think that's really important, right? So that in 2020, there were 55 corporations, big corporations, that paid zero in taxes. If you're a big profitable corporation, why are you paying zero in taxes? So there should be a minimum tax rate. So I think that's a really important step forward. The Democrats were able to pass this 15% for minimum income tax.
Are you optimistic that some new legislation will get passed to deal with this problem?
Well, it's an election year. I don't know how much will get passed in divided government this year. But I think one of the important things is that next year, a lot of these Trump tax cuts expire. That's the way the Republicans set them up to try to make them seem like they don't cost as much. And so there will be a big fight over that. So we're saying, you know, these Trump tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy, they should not be extended and certainly shouldn't be extended for people making more than $400,000 a year. The rich corporations, they don't need more tax cuts. They have enough. You know, we should really be instead raising taxes on the rich and corporations and investing in everyday Americans, you know, in education and healthcare and all the things that families need to thrive.
So if the tax rate before the Trump cuts was 35% and Trump lowered it to 21% and Biden, what does he want, 28%?
Right.
Was that sort of him saying, well, let's compromise? Or do you know the logic of that?
I mean, perhaps. You know, we'd like to obviously to go as close back up to 35% as possible. corporations seem to still be pretty profitable with a 35% tax rate. But, you know, we need to take steps to raise it. Absolutely.
Anything else you want to add?
You know, I think that the big thing, and so just to say, we did this report with the Institute for Policy Studies, and we used data from one of our partners from ITEP and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And, you know, I think what this shows is that, you know, we need to have more policies so that the corporate America is paying their fair share in taxes. And, you know, we shouldn't have big, wealthy, profitable corporations paying their executives more than they're paying in taxes.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone will propose a law banning or putting a limit on how much executives can be paid. You know, not 300 times as much, maybe just 10 times as much. I guess that would be too, in the corporate world, that would be considered outrageous.
You know, it is certainly something that we need to make sure that corporations are paying their fair share. There's certainly a lot of ways to do that.
That was David Kass of Americans for Tax Fairness speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Birdie. Thanks for being with us.
Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September,